From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. When does the rebuilding process begin for Major League clubs, or does it ever end? Ahead on Only a Game, a conversation with former Toronto Blue Jays general manager J.P. Ricciardi. Also, Around the World Cup in 7 minutes with SI soccer writer Grant Wall, and a conversation with climber Ed Beesters, author of K2, Life and Death on the World's Most Dangerous Mountain. Also ahead, a professional postseason forecast for what has regrettably become the world's coolest game.
The weather certainly not looking very nice in New York City for the Yankees and Angels. Temperatures holding in the 40s. People heading to the game are definitely going to need to bundle up. Sounds more like football weather to me, but I guess we're going to have to deal with it.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Last night in Los Angeles, the Philadelphia Phillies wasted a pitching performance as exemplary as it was unexpected. Pedro Martinez shut out the Dodgers on 2 hits for 7 innings, only to see his bullpen mates and his infielders allow the Dodgers to score twice, win the game 2-1, and even the National League Championship Series at 1 game apiece. The series moves to Philadelphia, where Game 3 will transpire tomorrow. Behind a strong performance by pitcher C.C. Sabathia, the New York Yankees took a 1-game-to-none lead in the American League Championship Series by beating the Anaheim Angels 4-1 in New York. As a capacity crowd clothed in muckluck scarves, caps with flaps on their ears, mink, methinks, and engulfing mufflers of the old coach days, the Yankees scored twice in the first inning, thanks in part to shaky play by the opposition. Sabathia went 8 strong innings for the win. Tonight, there will be more baseball in New York, we hope.
It's going to be another brisk, chilly night. Again, temperatures holding in the 40s. People heading to the game are definitely going to need to bundle up because that wind is going to continue to howl out of the northeast at 15 to 20 miles per hour.
That's AccuWeather.com senior meteorologist John Feerick. Meanwhile, in Philadelphia, they're hoping to play some baseball tomorrow night, a circumstance for which Mike Buchholder, the head groundskeeper for the Phillies, is preparing as well as he can.
You put your tarp down and see what nature deals you. So you're not ever going to beat Mother Nature. So you just kind of sit back and see what's going to happen and deal with it as it comes your way.
Who can fail to regard these circumstances as offering a potential deja vu all over again? Last fall, despite forecasts of miserable weather, Game 5 of the World Series began in drizzle and continued in downpour. Joe Henderson, who writes about baseball for the Tampa Tribune, had followed the American League champion Rays to Philadelphia for the series. From the outset of Game 5, he was dismayed.
Rain was constant. In some cases, it was blowing sideways. The flags were standing stiff, and it was just bone-chilling cold.
The problems with playing baseball under those conditions are numerous. Pitchers whose hands are so cold and wet they can't feel the ball are likely to lose control of their fastballs, which can become even more dangerous than normal. Fielders and base runners are more likely than usual to pull muscles. Fans are inclined to curse the baseball commissioner and wish they'd stayed home to watch So You Think You Can Dance. John Miller, who was calling the game on ESPN Radio, remembers that he was ready to embrace any potential evidence that continuing to play the game was an acceptable course of action.
I remember everybody was relieved that P.J. Upton stole second base in the rain, which I think lent credence to the umpire's assertion after the fact that the field was still playable.
The idea being that he didn't slide on out into left field.
Yeah, that he just didn't disappear as if he'd run into some quicksand.
John Miller and everyone else watching that game wondered whether it would be declared official if it was washed out before it could go 9 innings. Commissioner Bud Selig had decided that the World Series could not end that way, that the game would be suspended, then finished when the weather cleared. But neither the players, the announcers, nor the fans knew about the commissioner's decision. The Rays took the commissioner off the hook by tying the game in the 6th, after which it was mercifully halted. The Phils became champions by winning the rest of the game 2 nights later. During the offseason, the owners certified that no postseason game could be won in less than 9 innings, so at least if the weather interferes with this fall's contests, we'll all know what to expect. Unhappily, interference is not entirely out of the question, at least in Philadelphia tomorrow night.
Temperatures probably Sunday night in the middle 40s. We'll have a wind probably out of the north at about 10 to 15 miles an hour. The wind will be blowing in for that game, but probably just a few lingering showers. And then by Monday, things should be drying out in both New York and Philadelphia.
Which is great, except that by Monday, the Yankees and Angels are supposed to be in Anaheim, and the Phils are supposed to have finished the first of their games in Philadelphia. And as the days get shorter and the nights get colder, if either the Phils or the Yankees move on, we can all look forward to East Coast games in a World Series that can't end before November 1st and might go as late as November 5th. And that's assuming it doesn't rain or snow on the wrong nights between now and then. It might be enough to convince a baseball purist to root for the Dodgers and the Angels. In October, the field of major league teams still playing baseball keeps shrinking, while the number of teams with nothing to do but prepare for next year keeps growing. Joining me now to discuss the off-season intricacies of building or rebuilding a team is former Toronto Blue Jays general manager J.P. Ricciardi. J.P., welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Let's start with the teams that are finished for the year. When it becomes clear that a club is not headed to the postseason, how soon does the GM begin planning for the following year, and what are some of the first steps?
I think in some cases, if a club knows they're pretty much out of it by the All-Star break, I think they might be looking at things that they could possibly do in the course of that season that lead into the following season. I think each club, depending on when their elimination is imminent, they look forward to, you know, trying to do some things. Maybe it's even trades late in the season that enable them to go forward into the next year.
Elimination is imminent is an interesting phrase, because managers tend to keep saying we're going to fight until the last possible minute, but general managers might have given up and started looking to the next year.
Well, I don't know if giving up is the right word. I think you're always trying to win every game you play. You're still competitive, and I think that's a manager's job, is to try to win every possible game and to play it the right way. You owe it to not only the organization, but you owe it to the game itself. I think as a general manager, you're smart enough to realize that we're not going to be in contention this year. What do we have that's available that we could use as an asset to get us something going forward? Or what areas do we want to improve on that we want to shift our attention to? It's a general manager's job to be realistic. It's a manager's job to do the best he can on the field.
Major league teams have a lot of sources for adding talent to their rosters. They've got the draft, they've got international players, free agents, trades, and, of course, their own minor league systems. How do executives in the game keep track of that number of possibilities and that number of players as they're looking to fill a team's needs?
Well, I think a lot of it is, you know, reading scouting reports. A lot of it is being in touch with your scouting department. There's a lot of preparation that goes into being ready for the off-season. Scouting reports compiled, rankings of other teams. There's a lot of information that is at your fingertips, but a lot of the information is basically how you go out and acquire that information in regards to your scouting and player development people.
Teams like the Oakland A's and the Minnesota Twins have become known for playing the so-called small ball with low payrolls, very few high-priced sluggers, and a real dependence on talent in their own farm systems. The Twins, of course, made the playoffs this year, but they were bounced pretty quickly by the Yankees. Can small ball win championships?
I think a lot of things have to go right. You almost have to have a magical year from the time the season starts till the time the season ends. There's a reason why Minnesota and Oakland and teams of that ilk have not won the World Series coming out of the American League. Florida did it in the National League, and I think the National League's a little different league than the American League, because ultimately in the American League, you're going to have to face the iron, which is the Red Sox and the Yankees, at some point, unless it's a fluke year where those guys don't make it. What Tampa did last year was pretty amazing, but I think this year really showed how much of an anomaly it really was, and the fact that they went from 67 wins to 96 or 97 wins.
The days when top players routinely spent their entire careers with a single team are obviously long over, but maybe there are some exceptions. Derek Jeter, for example, it's hard to imagine him playing for anybody but the Yankees. Are there other players in today's game who are truly untradeable in the way Ted Williams, Joe DiMaggio, Stan Musial, Carl Yastrzemski, I guess, too, were in their day?
I don't think so. You know, nothing
nothing surprises me in the game as far as who could possibly be traded. I think Jeter's one of the exceptions in the sense that he is probably in line with the DiMaggio's and the Mantles of the era. He's an icon. He is a Yankee. But he might be the one exception. I think all you have to do is look around at the recent Hall of Fame guys who retired, Smoltz and Glavin, and the current guys, the Randy Johnsons and the people like that. They're still out there pitching, but they've been on three, four, five different clubs.
You mentioned the iron in the American League. Of course, you worked for an organization that shares the division with two of baseball's biggest spenders, the Yankees and the Red Sox. How much harder did that make your job as a general manager in Toronto?
In the American League East, it's really tough for anybody in the division. For the 8 years I was in Toronto, the payroll was $50 million. I went 70, 80, 90, and then this year, by the time the season was over, we were down to about $64 million. So it's a tough division to play in unless you have the resources, and you're probably talking about a minimum resource of about $110, $115 million when you look at the context of those two clubs having $140 to $200 million payroll. So you don't have to spend all that money. But it helps if you have the resources to be able to get that. I know a lot of people, you know, don't agree with that, but I think those are the people that don't play in the American League East, and I don't think they get to see the power that you have to play against night in and night out.
So is it fair to say that often a general manager's job comes down to the amount of money an owner is willing or able to spend?
I think that would be unfair. I think a lot of the general manager's jobs are based on the fact of what your ownership wants to do, what their commitment is to winning, and what division you play in. We were a perfect example. We won 87, 83, and 86 games 3 years in a row, and we didn't even sniff the playoffs. And even this year, we had a 75-win club in the American League East that didn't spend a dime that could have possibly been an 82 to 85-win club if we played in another division. So there's a direct correlation between success and failure based on the division.
JP, we've been talking about building and rebuilding teams. You were fired by the Blue Jays just a couple of weeks ago. Any prospects as far as you're joining a team in the process of rebuilding this offseason?
I spent 30 years in professional baseball, and I haven't had much time off in those 30 years, and 8 years as a GM going 24/7. I'm going to take a little time to myself here and my family, and I have a year left on my contract, so I'm going to just kind of, like I said, decompress a little bit. I've gotten a lot of calls from a lot of different clubs asking me what I'd like to do, but right now I'm just not in a hurry to rush into anything, and I'm going to sit back and just see what comes down the road.
J.P. Ricciardi served as the general manager of the Toronto Blue Jays from 2001 through this season. J.P., thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, no problem. Take care. All the best.
You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcasts, or peruse our archives by visiting our website at onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Brandon Hiles, age 7, was playing football in his backyard in Wintersville, Ohio, when the ball bounced into the woods bordering the yard. When Brandon tried to retrieve the ball, a deer that considered itself a free safety, and Brandon, a running back, charged the lad and flipped him into the air. Then, apparently unable to actually recover the fumble with its hooves or with its antlers, the deer retreated into the woods. A police officer summoned to the scene of the scrimmage said Brandon had inadvertently gotten between two bucks preparing to fight each other. We'll have to take the officer's word for that, since the deer, having run off, was not available to say, "Boxing's for chumps, I'm a football player."
Then dance to that deer, hunter's poker. Perhaps we'll get a buck like we're supposed to. Climb up in this tree and sit right next to me.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a veteran of the war in Iraq returns home to resume his studies and his soccer playing. But first, last weekend and Wednesday, in the last two rounds of World Cup qualifying, the U.S. team was among the many securing spots in the summer's finals in South Africa. Grant Wall was in Honduras to witness the U.S. team's 3-2 win on the road and he joins me now. Grant, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
On Wednesday night, the U.S. played Costa Rica in a game that might have been meaningless for the home team, since the U.S. had qualified for the World Cup final by beating Honduras last weekend. But emotionally, that Wednesday night game was anything but meaningless.
Yeah, it's a tragic thing that happened. In the wee hours of Tuesday morning, Charlie Davies, the rising star U.S. forward, was in a very serious car accident on the George Washington Parkway in Washington, D.C. It was a fatal car accident for another passenger in the car. Davies will live, but he also broke his femur, broke his tibia in his right leg, broke his elbow, and had facial fractures, as well as a lacerated bladder. I think a lot of people just hope that he'll be able to get better and, you know, perhaps play again.
Lots of observers felt that the U.S. team might have to wait until Wednesday night's home game against Costa Rica to assure themselves a spot in South Africa. Were you surprised that they got the job done in Honduras?
I was surprised because the Hondurans have played very well in World Cup qualifying. They eventually did qualify on Wednesday night for the first time since 1982, and they were undefeated at home in World Cup qualifying. So for the U.S. to get behind 1-0 in that game and score three unanswered goals in the second half and finish the deal when it comes to World Cup qualifying, that was a really positive thing. It shows well for the U.S., and if they can have that kind of response in South Africa next year at the World Cup, they can make a nice run, perhaps.
Well, as you mentioned, Honduras is in, and part of the reason they're in is because the U.S. beat Costa Rica on Wednesday, the first time Honduras has qualified for the final since 1982. What was the response like in Tegucigalpa?
The response was amazing. You've got to hear some of the stuff on the Internet as far as the live radio call on Honduran radio, because it took the U.S. scoring a goal in the 95th minute against Costa Rica to put Honduras into the World Cup. And it's amazing to hear how excited the Hondurans were, and to see the videos of people in Honduras celebrating in the streets, even waving American flags and chanting gringos, gringos. After the game. This is an only-in-soccer-type moment, and it was really special.
Argentina did not qualify for the finals in South Africa until they won on Wednesday night 1-0 over Uruguay. Argentina's coach, Diego Maradona, has been criticized for indecision, indiscretion, and various other transgressions. Will he still be coaching the team this summer?
Well, he may and he may not be. He started making some noises last week that he may not be the coach even if they did qualify, which they did. The fact is that Maradona may be the greatest player in the history of soccer, but like a lot of great players, he does not make for a good coach. And he's been pretty abysmal, actually, in coaching Argentina, which has one of the world's most talented lineups. As a journalist, I'd love to see Maradona in South Africa next year because he provides great copy and he's a total hoot. But for Argentina to have a chance of winning the World Cup, I think they need a different coach.
Based on the play in the recent qualifying rounds, Grant, what other teams have either delighted or disappointed you?
Well, Brazil is the best team in the world right now, and I think they're going to be the favorite in South Africa along with Spain. Teams that are disappointing, obviously Argentina. I think France as well has a ton of talent on that team, and they've scratched their way into the playoff in Europe, but they haven't clinched a berth yet in the World Cup. We'll see if France can make it in.
Grant, the days of the MLS regular season are dwindling down. We don't have time to even name all the teams that could still qualify for the MLS postseason, but wouldn't it be appropriate if Seattle, filling its stadium game after game in their first season, made the cut?
Yeah, it really would, and it looks like Seattle probably will make it into the playoffs. The question for me is, do they have a chance to make it to the final, which is being held in Seattle, which really has become Soccer City USA this year, drawing more than 30,000 fans to home games. I think it would be a great story to follow them throughout the playoffs and see what they can do.
Is it fair to say that what has made Commissioner Garber happiest this fall is that the L.A. Galaxy, with some fellow named Beckham, will actually be in the playoffs this time around?
I'm having a hard time wrapping my mind around Beckham actually making the MLS playoffs, but the Galaxy has been playing so well of late that I think they have a chance to win the MLS championship this year. And Bruce Arena has done a great job coming into L.A. and turning things around as the coach, getting a defense that actually defends, and having Landon Donovan continue playing very well and get along with Beckham, which was a real concern when Beckham returned to the Galaxy this year, and Donovan had said some public things criticizing him.
Said them, most of them, to you.
Yeah, in my book, The Beckham Experiment.
Who else should we be paying attention to as we get into the playoffs in MLS?
Yeah.
Columbus is the defending champ.
And Columbus is the team that has had the best record in the league this season. Robert Varziha took over as coach for Ziggy Schmid, who's now in Seattle, and they really haven't missed a beat, seems like. They got off to kind of a slow start, but have been really good since then. And Guillermo Barros-Schelotto, the MVP in MLS last season, is having another good year, and it looks like Columbus is ready to make another playoff run.
Grant Wall writes about soccer for Sports Illustrated, and he joins me on Only a Game from time to time as well. Grant, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
UMass Lowell, a state school 30 miles north of Boston, was ranked 8th in the 2009 National Soccer Coaches of America Division II preseason poll. The Riverhawks had a brand new coach, and the media guide proclaimed expectations are high. Things haven't gone exactly as planned. The Riverhawks have lost 9 out of their 12 games, but they are trying to turn things around with some unexpected help in the backfield. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
At the ripe old age of 26, just 1 week shy of his 27th birthday, John O'Brien is a junior at UMass Lowell. When he returned to the school last spring, it was as a full-time student and assistant coach for his former soccer team. But today, instead of retreating to the quiet of the coach's office, O'Brien is fighting with a younger generation over control of the radio in the weight room.
When I get in here first, I usually put country music on. Big fan of country, maybe some classic rock. I couldn't tell you what this is. I just don't know.
O'Brien was a defensive standout for the Riverhawks back in 2003 when he helped take the team to the NCAA quarterfinal round. He was enjoying life as a student athlete, on scholarship, and playing for a team he loved when he decided to leave.
The team was awesome. We had just come off the best season that the program's seen. That made it even harder. I was a captain, actually. But it was, I think it was worth it. You know, that was the big decision. Is it worth it? You know, is it something that's, you know, greater than you? So that was more the decision.
O'Brien didn't change schools or leave college to start his career. In the summer of 2004, John O'Brien decided to join the Army, knowing that he would likely be sent to fight in Iraq. After basic training and a 30-day stint in New Orleans post-Katrina, Iraq is exactly where John O'Brien went. To say that people back home in Massachusetts were surprised by his decision is putting it mildly.
The town I grew up in North Andover, it's not common as it is in certain places in the country for people to join the military right away. It just wasn't a common practice.
I was shocked, actually. I was all you could think about after that is just, you know, when is he going to come back? You know, hopefully everything goes well, and, you know, he's a good guy.
Christian Figueroa played soccer with O'Brien at North Andover High School and had followed his friend and mentor to UMass Lowell. Over the 15 months that O'Brien was in Iraq with the 82nd Airborne Division, Figueroa and the rest of the team waited eagerly for reports on how he was doing. In the first few weeks, his vehicle ran over a roadside bomb. In April 2007, suicide bombers rammed a patrol base in Sada, 40 miles northeast of Baghdad. 9 members of the 82nd Airborne were killed, and O'Brien was awarded a Purple Heart for his injuries. In all, 22 members of O'Brien's unit died during his tour of duty. Still, he says he's glad he went.
Can't get those experiences any other way but to, you know, take a chance. You have to leave some things behind, but it was worth it. It was a good time.
You just described war as a good time.
Yeah, I mean, it's overall it is. At times it's very hard, but on the bigger scheme of things, it's just seeing, you know, what the guys in your unit are capable of doing, what they're willing to do, not for themselves, but for whether it's the Iraqi people or the guys in their unit. in tough times, it really pulls out the best in people.
When O'Brien came back to UMass Lowell, it was to pursue a degree in criminal justice, not to play soccer. In the first team photo of the year, O'Brien's wearing a gray coach's shirt and sitting alongside his old friend and fellow assistant coach, Christian Figueroa. But when the team had an unexpectedly rocky start to the season, the former teammates had an idea.
Christian actually came up with it. He was like, well, you still have eligibility left, and I was a full-time student. He said, you know, why don't we just go check with our compliance director and see if it's even possible? You know, I was in class at the time, and he texted me back and said, it's good, you know, you can do it if you want.
O'Brien doesn't admit to being excited and humbly says he only came back to the team because the guys said it would help. But Figueroa says that's just O'Brien being O'Brien.
He was. He gets excited a little bit. He won't show it. You're right. He's very modest. You know, when he says he'll do it if he thinks it helps, he knows it will help. You know, we didn't ask him to come back for a favor.
Get you a quick feed there, John. All right, Richard.
Coach Brian Scales didn't know John O'Brien before he left for the Army. He wasn't here when the team was getting updates from O'Brien's unit in Iraq. But he knew when he took this job last spring that he had inherited an assistant coach who was a war vet. And he says everyone here has respect for that.
You don't see that too often. Someone that leaves the kind of cushy environment of collegiate athletics to go to war. And whether you're for or against the war, you respect a guy like that with all you have.
Hey, hey! Stop.
You'd never know from watching O'Brien that he's the old man on the team, whose body has trouble with long bus rides and day after day of practices. But Coach Scale says O'Brien's biggest challenge is transitioning back from a soldier's body built to carry a lot of weight to a soccer body that can dart between opponents on the field.
You know, he's doing a lot more running. He's got to cover a lot more ground. And now we just have to start to get him back into that flexible, athletic type of soccer body. So he'll get there.
What O'Brien lost in speed and flexibility during his years in the military, Scales says, he gained in experience and maturity. O'Brien was always known as a player who had strong organizational and leadership skills in the backfield, and his coach says he still is.
He's been a pleasure to coach. You know, he sees a lot of things that we see from the sideline, you know, right there in the middle of the field. So you talk about having a coach on the field, he literally is a coach on the field.
But how do his teammates feel about having a player nearly 10 years their senior hanging out in the locker room?
Well, he does have gray hair. But he is a young guy mentality.
Corey Samuelson is a senior defender for the UMass Lowell soccer team.
No, I'm thrilled, actually, because, you know, rather than him being on the sideline, you know, saying stuff to me, I like him coming with me so we can kind of, like, knock around the ball and makes it more enjoyable, more competitive, and obviously has another spin that most guys can't even imagine outside of soccer.
O'Brien says his teammates can ask him about his time in the Army if they want, and the players say they'd be happy to listen if O'Brien ever wants to bring it up. But no one seems all that interested in talking about the war. Senior goalkeeper Ryan Richards says even though he doesn't talk about it, O'Brien puts things in perspective.
He understands, like, we have, you know, our hard times with school or soccer or whatever it is, but at the same time, it's sometimes hard to complain when you look at him and see what he's been through. You can't say how hard anything is until you've talked to John O'Brien.
Currently on a 7-game losing streak, the Riverhawks might feel they have a thing or two to complain about. Everyone expected the team to do well this year, but after key injuries, the Riverhawks are just hoping to pull off a win or two before it's all over. O'Brien and his teammates have their next chance to do just that tonight at Southern Connecticut State University. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
You're listening to Only a Game. On last week's program, Charlie Pierce and I discussed, among other things, Rush Limbaugh's attempt to buy the St. Louis Rams. Mr. Limbaugh has since been cashiered out of that group of potential owners. Anyway, regarding my conversation with Charlie, Roseanne Armstrong, a WBUR listener, wrote, "Hearing Mr. Littlefield call Rush Limbaugh a chubby racist was offensive. Just to set the record straight, I didn't call Mr. Limbaugh a chubby racist. Charlie did. Ms. Armstrong goes on to suggest that Mr. Limbaugh should be judged not by his bulk, which is, one has to acknowledge, considerable, but by his character. One of these days, I'll have to invite Charlie to take on that challenge. Charlie's also the guy who inspired an email from Tom Crevett, who hears Only a Game on KCUR in Kansas City. I took exception to Charlie Pierce's reference to the Hunt family's right-wing craziness, he wrote. I have the same perception of H.L. Hunt, Lamar's father, but Lamar gets credit, lots of it, for signing players from small black colleges when the NFL was not open to them. Buck Buchanan, Willie Lanier, and Otis Taylor come to mind. It looks pretty progressive to me. Sharon Hunter, a fan of the WNBA, emailed to say she found Only a Game's coverage of that league's finals pathetic. It's a shame Bill Littlefield can't be bothered to educate himself and support a really great sport, she wrote. For the record, I'm not the one who hasn't educated himself and doesn't follow a great sport. It's Charlie. And finally, in last week's conversation with Ray Didinger, the co-author of The Ultimate Book of Sports Movies, I rashly declared that nobody had ever been inspired by the movie Caddyshack. Katie Meisner of Bloomfield, Ontario, called to mildly disagree.
Are you insane? So many people are inspired by Caddyshack. That movie is all about the ability to keep going no matter how ridiculous things around you are. The ability to just keep lining up for the Cinderella story one more time. To keep doing the things that don't matter. To keep fighting the gopher, to keep mowing the lawn. And most importantly, to be the ball, Danny. Be the ball.
You, too, can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can also reach us through the website, onlyagame.org, or you can write us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
When Logan Campbell, a boxer in New Zealand, went to Beijing to compete in the 2008 Olympics, the experience cost him over $100,000, most of which he got from his parents. Determined to avoid that sort of expense in the 2012 Games, Campbell opened a business to generate the money he would need to compete in London. Its advertisements had made plain that the profits would be applied toward his Olympic participation. The New Zealand Olympic Committee was aware of Logan Campbell's plan and said nothing about it for several months, but this week a committee spokesman said Campbell's business was, quote, totally inconsistent with the Olympic values and warned him to close up shop. Have you guessed by now what Logan Campbell is selling? Hint, brothels are legal in New Zealand. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the world's most dangerous mountain as described by one of the people who has climbed it. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
It is the time of the season when baseball teams in the playoffs generally reward their managers with contract extensions. Joe Torre's Dodgers are one of only four teams still eligible to win the World Series. Time to renegotiate?
Well, you would think so, but he doesn't, apparently. He says he's not going to manage the Dodgers after his contract expires. I mean, 69 years old, he's proven the one thing as a baseball manager he had left to prove, which was that he could win without George Steinbrenner's bankroll, although Frank McCourt's bankroll is nothing to sneeze at, although his wife may be sneezing at
half
at this
of it
point.
Will be what half he sneezes at. Soon.
You know, I take him at his word that next year will be his last season.
As you predicted last week, it was three and out for the St. Louis Cardinals, thanks to the aforementioned Dodgers. Which is worse, losing three straight in the first round of the playoffs or learning shortly thereafter that your best player is in no particular hurry to sign a contract extension?
Well, Albert Pujols is not in a hurry to sign a new contract, and he says, I have 1 year remaining in my contract for 2010 and a club option for 2011. I leave the rest in God's hands. One bends over backwards not to mock the use of the deity, but the notion that God has anything to do with exactly how many millions you're going to take to play baseball and where you're going to take them strikes me as far more blasphemous than making fun of it. So I'm going to make fun of it and go, Albert, God doesn't give a damn where you signed to play baseball.
Oh, the emails we'll get. But all right. Chicago Cubs filed for bankruptcy on Monday. Is this a requirement in Major League Baseball? If you don't win the World Series every 100 years or so, you have to declare bankruptcy?
Oh, you know, so many jokes in so little time, Bill. I have always loved Cubs fans because they took their legacy of failure with far less Harvard poetic seriousness than the Red Sox. They took their legacy of failure with something of a smile.
And a
but
beer.
There's really absolutely no reason to heap this on them on top of everything else.
The Oakland Raiders do not have the worst record in the National Football League, but their 1-4 start is nothing to be particularly proud of, and two of their three home games have been blacked out due to poor ticket sales. But is it really enough to justify being called the laughingstock of the NFL by a member of your own team?
Well, the problem with what Greg Ellis said is that they are the laughingstock of the NFL and will be, you know, as long as they're owned by a superannuated crazy man. But what Ellis said really makes sense. He says the mood we should be in is that we're kind of the laughingstock of the NFL. But he went on to say it isn't anything new. Teams have been that way before. New England wasn't always winning Super Bowls. And, boy, you could say that again.
Oh, yeah.
This was a team that once played a home game in Birmingham, Alabama. So what Ellis is saying basically is, look, it's really bad around here, but it can turn around. In fact, the NFL is structured so that teams will turn around.
Elsewhere in pro football, the New England Patriots, the very team we were discussing, apparently figuring that experience counts, have brought a 40-year-old linebacker out of retirement. Again, good move.
Junior Seau, for the third time, will be joining. I think this is primarily a locker room teaching moment for the Patriots. I don't suspect Junior Seau will contribute very much on the field. But with a team that's struggling to find its defensive identity and trying to get younger at the same time, he will be a good presence to have around.
Today, Texas meets Oklahoma for what is, for some, the most eagerly anticipated college football game of the season. But this year, Texas is ranked number 3. Oklahoma is way down at number 20, leading the Dallas Morning News to report that Sooners coach Bob Stoops is, quote, missing his mojo. You think so?
It's because I went back in time and stole it for $1 billion. Bob Stoops' biggest problem is that his Heisman Trophy award-winning quarterback isn't healthy and his defense isn't playing very well. And Texas has been laying for this game for a while. I suspect bad things in the Red River Shootout for the Sooners.
Three members of the Cleveland Cavaliers, including LeBron James, are being treated as if they have swine flu in all six
You
Cleveland
mean medically,
players,
right? Not yes. People aren't just treating them like they're
Precisely.
Diseased.
Precisely. Okay. In all six Cleveland players have flu symptoms this season. So they've had it, right? Forget the Cavs this year.
Yeah, they're done. I mean, you know, when they're playing for the NBA Finals next August or whenever it is, I suspect we won't remember this. But this is going to be a factor because anyone who's ever traveled with an NBA basketball team will tell you that by about the middle of February, the team playing sounds like a consumptive ward. Everybody has a cold. Everybody has low-grade fever. Everybody's immune system is down. The NBA travel schedule has been surreal for 50 years and doesn't make any more sense than it is. So, yeah, this is going to be a serious factor around the NBA as the season goes along.
Charlie, we've long known that Washington Capitals star Alexander Ovechkin is very good at playing hockey there, but does 2 goals in 28 seconds against the Sharks Thursday night inspire you to come up with, I don't know, perhaps a stronger word than good?
I said it before, I'll say it again. There are only two or three athletes in American sports right now that compel me to watch them, and Alex Ovechkin is one of them.
After his team managed to squeak through World Cup qualifying on Wednesday, embattled Argentina coach Diego Maradona was kind enough to give an impromptu interview on live television, although I think if I were the head of FIFA, soccer's governing body, I would perhaps wish that he hadn't.
I'm not exactly sure if I'm going to quote Diego verbatim because, you know, even on public radio. And then, as the Guardian account of it said, Maradona then grabbed his genitals with both hands, signaling some sort of insult to the television camera. How do they know? Can they read his mind?
Isn't that spectacularly British? I believe it was signaling some sort of insult.
The NASCAR Hall of Fame has announced the inductees in the inaugural class, and so I would have assumed that you would have gotten a big envelope in the mail or a 3 a.m. phone call, Mr. NASCAR, but no, I'm shocked.
Isn't it bizarre it's taken this long for NASCAR to have a Hall of Fame?
I mean,
everything's
marvelous.
Got a Hall of Fame. Freshwater fishing has a Hall of Fame. I do like the fact that at the head of the list is Bill France Sr. Yes, I believe that when you invent something, you ought to be in its Hall of Fame. I think that's one of the very loose standards I have for behavior. Yes.
Seems right.
Yes, I think Thomas Edison should be in the Light Bulb Hall of Fame.
Jenny Chapman, a 60-year-old grandmother
sports.
From Cambridgeshire, England, has set a record, and that's why it's sports, a record of sorts, though it might be the sort of record that Mrs. Chapman and her family wish that she hadn't set.
First of all, I'd like to point out that Jenny is from Deeping St. James, which is even more British than the account of what Diego Maradona did earlier. Wouldn't you love to go to Deeping St. James High School?
I would.
Anyway, Jenny snores at 111.6 decibels, which happens to be louder than an airplane, washing machines, tractors, and a speeding express train.
Mm.
No mention if she's more powerful than a locomotive, however.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he puts no one to sleep, and so nobody snores during this segment at least. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill, and thank you to all you folks in Deeping St. James.
To say that Ed Veasters climbs mountains would be like saying Michael Jordan played some hoops or Meryl Streep has done some acting. When Veasters is asked how often he has climbed Mount Everest, he probably has to think about the question for a few moments before answering. 7, 8, maybe he's not even sure. Ed Veasters' new book is K2, Life and Death on the World's Most Dangerous Mountain, and he joins me now from NPR in New York. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
What makes K2 the world's most dangerous mountain?
Well, we chose the word dangerous because rather than deadly, which is more of a statistical definition, dangerous can be an opinion or an idea that you label something with. And people, when they go to K2, they're so enamored with the fact of trying to get to the top. They're willing to do a lot and willing to risk a lot to climb it. And because of that, people have problems and die on that mountain more than they do probably anywhere else statistically.
Ed, I kept my introduction short because I want you to characterize yourself a little bit. What would you say is your most significant achievement as a climber?
Well, I just completed in the spring of 2005 an 18-year project, which I called Endeavor 8000, where I set out to climb the 14 highest mountains in the world that are all over 8,000 meters, 26,000 feet. It took me 18 years to do that. I had a lot of successes along the way. I had a lot of near misses, but that would, for me, be my gold medal. That was my Super Bowl, to stand on the summit of Annapurna, which was then the 14th peak of that series.
Very early in K2, the new book, you contend that non-climbing journalists can never seem to get our stories right. What do the journalists get wrong when they write about you?
A lot of them, and I think a lot of the general public, have an opinion of climbers as we go out and we seek the risk. You know, we do it for the excitement and the near-death experience. And what I try to convey to people and talk about and teach is that, you know, we accept the risk that's there, and I try to manage the risk in a safe way because ultimately, you know, I want to climb the mountain, but the end goal is to make sure that I get home. And whatever comes in between there is kind of up to me, how I plan, how I prepare, the people that I go with, and the journey itself. So we seek the challenge, but we kind of have to accept the risk.
You write that you don't like to second guess or criticize the decisions made by other climbers, either on climbs that you're participating in or other climbs altogether. But in this book, you do seem to have found that temptation irresistible. What led you to start expressing that sort of criticism?
I don't think we were too harsh or too critical. I think what we tried to convey, you know, both David Roberts and myself, was we tried to just point out the obvious, how certain things go very well, how certain teams work together very well, and then there's the complete opposite. You know, a lot of the stories we read, they're very romantic and glamorous, but the behind-the-scenes stuff, you know, the voices of other people that were on those trips often don't get told, and I think that's what we tried to do. And I just wanted to kind of make examples, again, about great teamwork, bad teamwork, good leadership, bad leadership, with a little bit of an opinion.
Can you give us a more specific example of somebody who isn't really pulling his weight, somebody you've encountered in that situation on a climb?
Specifically, probably not, but in general terms, you know, I've seen and been on climbs where the majority of people are really putting in a lot of energy and effort during the weeks and weeks of buildup of supplying camps and fixing rope and breaking trail. And then there might be a few or one or two people kind of in the background, maybe just kind of floating along a little bit and not really contributing, thinking that if they save themselves and save their strength and energy, they might be able to go to the summit later. And it's happened on other teams where the actual leaders of the teams seemingly have selected those summit people at the beginning and kind of save them for that end when they want the strongest people to be available to go to the top. Whereas I've always felt that your opportunity to go to the summit should be based on your contribution throughout the expedition.
Of K2, which you characterized at one point in the book as the full meal deal of mountaineering, you write that if companies try to commercialize that climb, I guess the way that has happened with Mount Everest, it will be a sad day for mountaineering. Why is that?
For me, it was such a test piece, and I think it is for many avid, not necessarily professional, but very experienced climbers. We go to K2 to test all of our skills, and it is relentless, and it is also very rewarding in the end. It's much harder to climb than Everest, and I think it would be very difficult to start guiding large groups of people up the mountain. They would have to need a whole nother level of skill beyond what you need for Everest to climb K2. And to see droves of people attempting the mountain, it would be a sad day. And in fact, this summer, of multiple expeditions and attempts on K2, nobody succeeded, whereas there was multiple ascents of Everest. So right there and then, you can see the defining nature of how hard K2 is and how difficult it is actually to climb.
I think my favorite single sentence in this book comes in the epilogue, and it reads as follows: climbing Everest again seemed reasonable. You've been on the mountain when people have died there. You've seen that firsthand, and you've helped rescue people in terrible circumstances as well. Is climbing Mount Everest ever, quote, reasonable?
I said it, and I believe it, yeah. You know, I've been there 11 times now, and I've reached the summit just recently for the 7th time. A lot of things and a lot of accidents that occur in the mountains are based on human error. And if you analyze the statistics of why people have injuries and deaths in the mountains, usually they've caused their own problems by climbing late, by climbing in bad conditions, by pushing themselves for the sake of success. And you really have to temper your ambition when you go to the mountains. You've got to weigh the odds. You've got to look at what works on that day and what might not work. And if you have to walk away, you walk away knowing that the mountain's going to be there for a lot longer than you are. You can always go back.
Because it strikes me that that's a simpler thing for someone to say if he has devoted his life to climbing mountains and is sponsored to do so by, you know, companies that make mountain climbing equipment and that sort of thing. Very difficult thing for somebody who has saved all their money for one shot and then is told, hey, the weather's not good enough. Sorry, we're going home.
You're right. I mean, it is a hard pill to swallow, but I look at it exactly the same way. You know, even though I've got sponsors and companies that are supporting me, they don't make the decisions for me near the summit. And whether I succeed or don't get to the top, they're still with me because they like how I do and why I do it. And I think the same thing should happen when people, you know, when they pay money to go on these guided trips, when they save all their money and plan for a year for that once in a lifetime opportunity, they should hopefully know and be with the people that surround them that, you know, we have to be allowed to go up. And if it's not going to work, you know what? We had a great adventure. We had a lot of fun. I met some new friends. I traveled across the world. And, yeah, I didn't get to the summit, but it wasn't a failure. It was simply a non-success because I wasn't allowed to go to the top.
Nothing in K2, the new book, suggests that you're tired of climbing mountains, and you'd have every right to be, as far as I'm concerned by this point, but where will you climb next?
I have plans to go a year from now to Antarctica to climb Vincent Massif, which is the highest point down there on that continent. And I'm, you know, it's a place I've never been before. Other people have climbed it, but for me, it's a brand new adventure. And so I still have small goals, little adventures that I have out there. I call them my carrots, you know, things that I have to look forward to, things that I have to train for. So I'll just kind of keep making it up as I go along.
Ed Viesters is the author of K2, Life and Death on the World's Most Dangerous Mountain, published by Broadway Books. He joined me from the studios of NPR in New York. Ed, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Jeremy Bernfeld. We had help from Jim Mr. Gopher Harrington and Peter Smoke Porterhouse Lydotes. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Karen Given's John O'Brien photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, learn more about the music you hear on our program, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from ESPN broadcaster John Miller.
Despite the forecast and whatever those people at the weather networks are telling us, I see nothing but blue skies from now on.
I like the optimism, sure, but what I really like is that John Miller's forecast will end up being just about as accurate as that of any meteorologist. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.